How was the bunkhouse? Alright? Survive. How many people were snoring in a room of five? It's what's called good training. Good. Okay. Did you arrive here during our first sit? You're actually here? Are you all here? Really here? Good. Yes, this place is a very good place for an event like this. And it has a very good, what we call atmosphere. A sort of English wabi-shabi. But that's because we're here, and we're really here. If we weren't here, really here, it wouldn't have that atmosphere. Today, I want to say something about responsibilities. We are members of Western Chan Fellowship, but more particularly, we're members of our own groups. And there are two levels of responsibility I want to talk about. One is responsibility within the group within which you practice. And the other, more generally, is about responsibility within the lineage to which we belong. But I thought the best way to start entering this subject would be to use one of my favorite koans, which some of you know already. So I'll tell you the koan as the opening story. As you know, in China and also in Japan, many monks go wandering. They wander from monastery to monastery and they go to different places. Basically, in order to find out the views of different masters and the atmospheres of different places. And sometimes when they find the right place, they'll settle and stay there. We actually came across that in action today when we were in China recently at the monastery of Chantong, which is the same monastery in which Dogen became enlightened and in which Hongzhi gave his marvelous talks on the science of illumination. We were shown the Chan Hall, and rather to our surprise when we went in there, we found that at the back of the town in which people were sitting, there were various curtains, and there were sounds of snoring and sleeping going on behind the curtains. And so we inquired into this, and said, well, yes, it's because there are itinerant monks who are coming here and spending some time with us, and then after a while they'll move on. That is in addition to our own monks who are practicing in the Chan Hall. So this tradition does continue today. Well, one day a monk rolled up to a monastery. He's very scruffy. He's travelled for a long distance. He's hopping along with his stick. And he comes in. It's a beautiful monastery. Wow. Wonderful architecture. Beautiful Chan Hall. Paintings. Statues. Gold glittering in the sunlight. He looks around and he goes, bah! Turns around and marches up. But when he gets to the monastery gate, he pauses and maybe I was a bit hasty. Maybe I'll go back and have another look. So he turns around, goes back into the monastery, and by this time the master has come into the Chan Hall and is seated on his throne. So the master sees this stuffy travelling monk coming in, so the master begins to make a greeting. But before he can complete the greeting, the monk goes, and walks out. This time, he doesn't come back. In the evening, the master says to the guest master, what happened to that noisy fellow? I guess I said, oh, he's gone away. Says the master. You know, that chap will set up monasteries on mountain peaks, but continue abusing the Buddhas and the patriarchs. What do you make of that? Well, it's very intriguing. Is the master's response a criticism? Or is it an approval? What do you think? Not so clear, is it? After all, the master says, how are that guy going to set up monasteries on mountaintops? But he'll continue abusing the Buddha and the patriarch. Sounds as though he's actually approving, in a way, but also kind of raising a query. What is the nature of this query? Well, of course, it's dangerous to try and interpret koans, but there's a few things that might well be said about this. What the monk appeared to be objecting to was decoration. Maybe the monastery was very beautifully decorated. But this monk found his dharma among the stones and the trees and the rivers and the sky. He didn't like decoration. He liked nature in the raw. But why should he be rather abusive about it? Well, he was quite abusive about it. The master, on the other hand, appears to have understood that the monk was concerned only with the dharma of the wilderness, the dharma of the mountains, the dharma of the valleys. The master seems to have known that. But the master, of course, also is the abbot of a very splendid institution, and he's certainly not going to downcry that. So perhaps there are two perspectives on what the Dharma is here. In the case of the travelling monk, the Dharma is, as it were, naked. It's right there, eyeball to eyeball. That monk doesn't care whether there's a gale blowing and the trees are falling down and the snow is swirling past, or whether it's a beautiful, wonderful sunny day like today, peaceful and quiet. This, that's all the Dharma. The Dharma is the Dharma of the moment for him. And he is obviously a highly trained monk, otherwise he wouldn't be able to stand it. But he is a highly trained monk after all. Was wandering for it. So when he matures and decides, maybe I should do a bit of teaching now, where is he going to do it? Well, it should be somewhere like mine too, it only even worse. Some of you, I don't know many of you are left now, who were the original inhabitants of mine too. You may well remember that in those days there was no roof on the barn, and at night the owl would come in and perch on a rafter while we endeavoured to sleep below it. Those were the days. Well, this monk wouldn't even have allowed the roof to be caved up. He was that kind of guy. But is he missing something? Huh? Now the master, on the other hand, obviously had some appreciation of this. Otherwise he wouldn't have allowed that the monk was going to do valuable things up on the mountaintops. But the master knew something else. That not everybody can live in the raw crudity of nature. That people need comfort. And that some kind of encouragement, some kind of support is important for many people to be able to practice or even approach the Dharma, quite apart from the fact that art and craft and the beauty of painting is in itself an entirely legitimate human activity. What the master was appreciating is something that the Tibetans call supports. The Tibetans are very understanding that if you want to practice a Dharma, it has to be supported. And the Tibetans will talk about three kinds of supports. One kind of support is music, chanting. It supports the spirit of practice. Another kind of support is philosophy, the academic examination of the meaning of Buddha's words. That's actually a support. It's not essential. Not essential at all, especially in jhana. But it is valuable support, especially for those with an intellectual inclination. And then there are the buildings and the paintings and the ambience of a place which can be made very beautiful. That also is a support for the faithful. And remember that many Buddhists, especially in the Far East, are Buddhists by faith rather than by conviction. They're born to be Buddhists. They don't query the more questionable ideas, which really maybe come from Shamanism and Taoism, have other origins than pure Buddhism, but which all of which have got into Chinese Buddhism, for example, which is very complicated, with a lot of Taoism floating around in it and so on. And in Tibet, of course, 50% is shamanic. But no matter, because those elements have become the supports of the true Dharma which lies at the core. So the master, in his tolerance, was saying, this guy, he's a nature mystic. Okay, that's fine. Let him practice. He'll do good work. He will convey the true Dharma of the wilderness to those who join him. But what about the ones who can never live on a mountaintop anyway? The ones who can't even get there? Well, here I am. I offer you the beauty of this place. Come and join me here. We'll have a wonderful ceremony this evening with lots and lots of chanting. You'll like it. Come stand for a bit. These, therefore, this koan is a very interesting one because it really carries two contrasting approaches to what Dharma practice can be. The fact that Dharma practice is difficult because, putting the discussion at a slightly different level, let us consider this koan as a metaphor for the moment. We all know that the practice of Dharma is tough. If you really want to penetrate the meaning of Buddhist meditation, it requires guts. It requires a willingness to sit for long periods. It requires a willingness to challenge yourself in ways which are often very uncomfortable. All of this is conveyed by the metaphor of the wilderness and the metaphor of practicing in monasteries on tops of mountains. The monastic discipline in some monasteries is very demanding, even of the lay people who go and join it. This is probably especially in Japan. My impression is that from our visit to China, the Chinese are much more kindly disposed to visitors. In fact, I'll enjoy having them. Whereas in Japan, it seems that the first thing that happens when you arrive in a monastery is some kind of masochistic torture which you have to survive before you could even enter. I'm exaggerating, of course. But there's a tendency that way. You've got to, as it were, prove yourself as being fit to practice. So, one side of the metaphor of this koan is a metaphor that, yes, true chan training is not easy. And if you're going to take it on, you better be prepared for it. On the other hand, the institutions of chan, the lineages of chan, also offer a certain amount of comfort and support, knowing that the practice is difficult, And especially for beginners, you don't want to put people off. Why not, you might say? Why not put beginners off? It's really not tough enough. Why bother with them? Well, the answer to that is that you're trying to reduce the suffering of the world. That's for everyone. And many people are very, technically speaking, ignorant. Most people, for example, don't know that if you want to live a happy life, you have to challenge yourself. Most people go around just, as it were, presenting themselves to the world as if they were the all-important goddess of vacation, or God, or big bully boy, whatever, throwing their weights about, chucking their egos at other people, without even realizing that this actually is not only particularly bad for social relations, but it's also, in the end, going to cause them suffering. And of course this is true at many levels. It's also true at the national level, as the United States has just been learning over the last 10 years. If you chuck your weight about too much without thinking about an outcome, you're going to get into a problem. And then it takes a hell of a long time to work it all out. The Buddhist ideas operate at many levels. They are metaphorical at many levels. We can use the metaphor of the forest and the wilderness and the metaphor of the comfortable temple, and then we can translate that into metaphor of your own mind, or one can expand it to the metaphor of the selfishness of social units, races, societies, nations. At all of these levels where there is a self, the argument applies. You see, there is a British self, you might call it the national illusion, which we needn't go into right now. America is just waking up to its Republican illusion. And so we can go on like this. But the self is a term which applies to any self-containing something or other which is said as to go its own way without consideration of anyone else. For example, up the United Nations. Let's get on with it. We spoke yesterday about the Buddha's dangerous idea. Well, it's very dangerous for those sorts of people. Precisely because by ignoring the totality and the complexity of interactions and taking a limited self and pumping away with that, you're not going to get anywhere. Or rather, you're going to cause a load of disturbances than having problems. So there's a lot in this interesting little Quran. Like many Qurans, they can be unfolded and examined and interpreted at many levels. Which incidentally is one of the things that we do in our own Quran retreats, which we organize in a very Western fashion, not in the traditional Eastern fashion. We actually try to think about Qur'an, which is forbidden in most of the East. Mind you, we then discover that thinking is useless, and then we join up with the Chinese and the Japanese back where we should have perhaps started from. So, let's see what this Qur'an tells us about our own roles in our own personal practice. Well, clearly for a start, we are diverse. Some of us like the idea of meditation in the wilderness, finding a cave somewhere. Some of us wouldn't even dream of it. We need a hotel and an ensuite bathroom in order to even begin. There's quite a lot of Buddhist and other religious institutions which don't even start without having hotel rooms with ensuite baths. Of course, it's very clear the sort of people they're for, but still it's valid. Why not? So, but when we take up this challenge to investigate what the Dharma's about, we also actually have some sort of responsibilities. Now, responsibility is a little tricky word, perhaps. Now, in the West, I think we would recognize there's been a history, particularly with Zen, of believing that Zen, as it were, is a path to paradise. Paradise here being something like, okay, you do Zen, and then you get a magnificent experience which solves all possible problems. I'm expressing this slightly crudely, but it was undoubtedly the image of Zen which the great Daido Suzuki managed to convey in the 1930s, 40s, and way on into the 50s, when under people like Christmas Humphreys in Britain, it was the Daidet Suzuki approach, which really was Zen at that time. Daidet Suzuki was a Rinzai practitioner, and therefore his great message was, solve your koans, have Kensho, and Bob's your uncle, everything will be marvellous forever. You'll then be the great Buddha. You'll have discovered the Buddha mind. Of course, when people tried it, they found that it wasn't all that easy. What is a strange feature of Suzuki, that it wasn't until he was a very old man that he even acknowledged the existence of Soto Zen. He was quite old before he actually took up his pen and wrote anything about science illumination. It was all koans, big bangs, and great discoveries. This, of course, went along with the drug scene and the hippies and all the rest of it. It was all part of the time. It was extraordinarily one-sided. But still, to this day, many people who, Westerners who get interested as beginners in Zen, kind of pick up this picture that Zen is about magic, really. Magic which you have to work very hard for, be sensational for, and then you will have the Big Bang, and that'll be great. I'm exaggerating slightly, but not very much. I've had people join us at Mind Clearing with something like that picture in the back of their mind. And I must confess, when I first came across Zen, fortunately it wasn't through that approach. I came across Zen in Japan, in Hong Kong, with a very sensible Chinese teacher. But again, the tendency was still in that same kind of direction. Now, is there anything wrong with it? No, but it's one-sided. And this is what, in discussing Buddhism, we call a deviation. You get deviated away from the straight path by some kind of stress which goes too far to one direction or the other. We know, for example, that in Chinese history, the practice of science of illumination was also criticized very heavily from the other side. It could be argued that science of illumination was just quietistic sitting. You were sitting there just buzzing away in what has subsequently been called the cave of the demons, because you're just sitting there, as it were, mentally masturbating in some beautiful quietude. Doesn't get you anywhere. Of course, that's untrue, because again, that is an unfair criticism. Because actually, people like Hongzhi, who pressed the path of the science of illumination so wonderfully effectively, emphasized the need for illumination and one-pointed focus in the practice, which is altogether outside the realm of the criticisms which were being made. So there has been, within Zen, these mutual criticisms and these tendencies that deviate one way or the other. So, as one enters this field of Chan as a beginner, what kind of an attitude should one adopt to the, what is it you adopt? When you adopt charm, you start coming to weekends and doing things like coming here. Have you taken up a religion? No. Have you taken up an investigation? Well, maybe a little bit. No, mostly you feel comfortable with a group of people who are doing something that seems to you to be valid and different, and which seems to offer some kind of hope. I don't think in these days we should underestimate the way in which Buddhism and Chan offers a sort of hope. I don't want to go down this line more than a couple of sentences, but when you look at the state of the world, a lot of people who are concerned about the world feel despair. I belong to a small group of friends who consider it's a sort of male support club. And at times we have to admit to one another that, yeah, we're close to despair about the way in which the world is going, and the way in which the stupidities of politicians have, until recently perhaps, been going in entirely the wrong direction. So, Buddhism offers a sort of hope which doesn't depend upon the extraordinary schizoid split of the Western mind. What do I mean by saying that? I mean that, generally speaking, Western culture has God on one side and atheism on the other, and nothing much in between. Well, Buddhism, as it were, is a middle way. So, when one encounters a middle way, there's something rather seductive about this. Especially when you find that if you begin doing the practice, your mind indeed does begin to change. Leaving aside national problems and global problems, personal problems are also affected by even a little bit of meditation. So it's something which almost instantly begins proving itself. A bit of practice, a weekend's retreat, can make a big difference to many people, and of course they come back again. Or usually come back again. So if we usually come back again and actually begin to sit with the practicing community, another issue arises. Do we have a responsibility in relation to what we are undertaking? Now, this is a rather tricky, it's a tricky word for us. We don't like people talking about responsibilities because it suggests some kind of a limitation on our sacrosanct individuality. But actually, if you join any kind of a club, you need to ask, what are the acceptable behaviours around here? Now, when one starts sitting and practicing, one basically learns two things to start off with. These are about values. The values are that if you behave foolishly and ignorantly, you're going to generate more suffering for yourself and others. You're going to contribute to karma, and karma has to be paid back sometime or other. On the other hand, if you choose values which point you in a rather different direction, then you will achieve something like peace of mind. You'll be able to share that peace of mind with others. And something like love may actually, in the end, emerge. And I'm not speaking here about erotic love. I'm talking about that rather strange kind of love which is disinterested. Disinterested love is the result of meditation in the end. So, as one begins to begin the practice, one perhaps needs to think about, well, are my values actually changing? Is my behavior actually changing? Or am I still going out on binge nights, getting totally boozed and carried off by the police in order to be rescued and sent home? Exaggerating, of course, but you get the point. Most of us, including myself, have occasionally lived in situations of which the ethics might be questionable. Should one query those ethics? If one joins weekend sitting, can one at the same time be waltzing out and doing things which one's conscience would tell one are not wise, and which may be very painful to another person? I'm speaking here, of course, particularly about relationship difficulties, but not only. How does one begin to put straight one's life? Almost in a moralistic Christian way, because actually the values are the same. If you look at the Ten Commandments of Christianity, and if you look at the five precepts of the Buddhism, they're virtually the same. It's very interesting, in fact, that all of the major religions that have precepts are extremely similar to one another when they're talking about public and personal behavior. I find that very interesting as an evolutionary psychologist, because it does suggest that in the origins of humanity, humanity discovered that certain ways of behaving were both self and group destructive, whereas other ways of behaving led to peace, tranquility, and interaction. And it's very interesting that in spite of the huge differences between the Christian, the Islamic, and the Far Eastern cultures, whether it's Hinduism or Taoism or Buddhism, the underlying ethical program is very, very, very similar. It's, you could say, something like universal, although I'm not suggesting it's genetically universal, but something from our ancient past suggests what is good and what is evil. And when you think about it, it hinges around the self. Evil is nothing other than extreme forms of self-indulgence. Forms of self-indulgence which are so strong that you don't trouble about what happens to other people. On the other hand, the good is almost very frequently, not always, but usually, involves some kind of giving, or gratitude, or thanksgiving, or sacrifice. So there are principles here which are very, very important, and we need to consider them in relation to our daily life. And that is one of the reasons why, as an aid to this, we created the, the aspirational prayer. I'm not going to take you through it again right now, we read it once this morning, but the idea of this aspirational prayer is to remind one of the positive values which lie behind a life in the Dharma. In fact, of course, these aspirational prayers were drawn from the Dharma literature, obviously. Although it's a new writing, it's very classical in its form. So, I would encourage all groups, actually, in the Western Dharma Fellowship to quite regularly use those aspirational prayers. And if one... Yeah, I want to say this without kind of being moralistic, because certainly in my own life I've been tolerant of error, no doubt about that whatsoever, and therefore I don't wish to be pontificating about how other people should behave. On the other hand, I'm fully recognizing my own life the times when I've gone a bit astray have had to be paid for. Indeed. So, well, I think what I'm trying to say is everybody's different. Everybody has their own problems. But do get to work and try to do something about them. Try to put your lives straight, and I, without specifying how any one person should get it straight, investigate it. This wonderful Chinese word, tan, investigate, applies beautifully here. One can investigate the ethics of one's life, just as one can investigate the inner recesses of one's consciousness. Tan applies to the whole of one's personal life, not just the bit on the cushion. Now, from this comes some ideas of which I originally began thinking about this talk. And that is a very interesting occasion which occurred only a few weeks ago in Taiwan before Shifu died. Somebody who's quite well known to us, Guo Gu, is a Chinese-American who was originally an artist. But became a monk and became Shifu's personal assistant and remained so for some time and then decided he wanted an academic career and is now a professor. Guo Gu was a very good assistant for Shifu, I think. Maybe their relationship became a bit complex. But Guo Gu has remained a loyal practitioner. Chan had a good teacher. And Guo Gu took to Taiwan a group of about, 10, 12 of people who'd been training to teach the Dharma at Dharma Drum in New York. This teaching of Dharma Drum, by the way, is mostly from the books. It's not the same as practicing the meditation, it's teaching what the Dharma says. So this group of people who were moderately well trained in the ideas of the Dharma went with Guo Gu to New York and saw Shifu in the sort of brief period of clarity and openness just before he died. In fact, this would have been a few weeks after our own group of leaders went to New York. Now, our group of leaders is rather different, because our group of leaders is trained in basically the methods of sitting and in running retreats. Our group of leaders is mostly very defective so far as it understands the Dharma, and that there's something we have to repair and improve within the Western Chan Fellowship. So these two groups of leaders, Guo Gu's group mainly Dharma-oriented, our group mainly retreat-oriented, were two different kinds of groups. And Shifu put a very interesting question to these Americans. He asked them, "Are you transmitting the Dharma?" Now, this is a tricky question. Are you transmitting the Dharma? The word transmission is a rather powerful word, which we'll have to talk about a bit more, because strictly speaking, transmission means acknowledgement of somebody's enlightenment experience. Or it partly means that. This does not seem to be what Shifu was meaning here, because of course none of these people had done very much actual practice. In a way, perhaps, as was pointed out to me in a discussion yesterday, maybe, perhaps what Shifu was meaning was, are you spreading the Dharma? Are you sharing the Dharma? Very important question. Especially for those of us who are, as it were, still on the path of practicing for me, which is very sensible. We mentioned this yesterday. Practicing for me is fine, but it isn't. It's the beginning, not the end. You've got to practice for me first, because without self-understanding, how can you possibly help other people? But if you're only practicing for me, you're not sharing the Dharma. So Shifu's question is a very potent one. He says to these people, Are you revealing the Dharma to others? Are you spreading the Dharma? They were a very reticent lot, but most of them eventually said, yes, we are spreading the Dharma in this sense. We are indeed doing that, and we want to do it more. Now this question applies to everyone who takes up the Dharma, attending retreats and learning. So, what are the things that one learns in order to begin to spread the Dharma? First of all, of course, one learns about one's personal behavior. It's very obvious. Supposing you go around behaving in a grotesque fashion, it's going to be very clear that you're hardly recommending the Dharma to others. If you go along and say, well, I go to Zen groups weekly, but at the same time I go to binge nights every night, and I'm pissed every morning, I'm exaggerating, of course, but supposing that was the case, nobody is going to be very impressed by Zen. Okay, I'm exaggerating to make the point. I mean, I'm not suggesting that nobody should ever go on a binge night. If you want to go on a binge night, go on a binge night, but for God's sake, don't make a mess of the streets. Right. You can see what I'm saying, that personal behavior in everyday life is something which will either recommend your values to others or not, depending how they come across. And I think one of the kind of mnemonics which I like to use is particularly important here. And that is reflection, not reaction. This is well worth going into. In fact, I could do a whole talk on it, or we could have a whole discussion on it. What is reaction? Well, so often in life, something happens, one gets a little bit irritated, and one reacts. maybe generates a great row, or on the other hand, it might just be a little bit of a personal, personal spat. However, little personal spats have a way of kind of continuing in the background, and so on. I didn't go into all the human traits around spattishness. There's a problem. Where does it come from? It comes from the fact that the ego, my proper self, has been offended, and so I go, woof, nasty person. Don't we all do that? Am I the only one? Good, I'm glad I'm not the only one. What is the answer to that? The answer to that, of course, is reflection. A moment's reflection even will do it. To see that actually this spat has come about simply because two alternative views have clashed. And maybe this was a misunderstanding in the first place, and there wasn't even a clash to begin with. Reflection is enormously helpful. And what does reflection require? A deep breath and a step backwards. If one can, as it were, pause, reflect, and come up, did I hear you right? Very good question. Because that allows a second opinion. Did I hear you right? Have I got your meaning? You've just been called an absolute idiot. And so you say, did I get your meaning? This is the other person's opportunity to withdraw their insulting statement. I mean, there are lots of tricks of the trade here. But reflection basically means pausing, taking a deep breath, and considering one's case. I think I may have mentioned yesterday the technique for stopping rows. It is not to seek the last word. Or in my case, I found a very useful technique. It was in the middle of a row, just to look out of the window. Makes a difference. one has to discover these little tricks of the trade, which help you to gain time, which is what it's about. Reflection, not reaction. Enormously valuable. And of course will gain you, if you can practice this well, a certain amount of respect. Because people who react mindlessly, egotistically, all over the place, are not people who usually get much respect from others. So, what are the... I think we need to begin to wind this up a bit. So, what are the kinds of things that one needs to learn in the Dharma which would help one with this behavior and attitude in life? Well, first of all, this practice of reflection is greatly benefited, of course, by the practice of meditation. Sitting and calming the mind teaches one what calming the mind is. And before you start doing it, you don't know. All of us here, of course, do know, because we've practiced considerably, otherwise you wouldn't be here. We all know that there are levels of mental activity, some of which are very captivating, troublesome. But with the practice of the methods, gradually the mind can calm. Once one knows that the mind can actually be calm, then of course that has a spin-off into everyday life. So that in social interactions, for example, you may not be meditating, but reflection is part, as it were, of the meditative process anyway. When you are meditating, you are also moving from throwing out the reactions which are going on in your head, coming back to a reflection, the examination of a koan, the examination of a huatu, the question, how is life fulfilled, is a matter of reflection. So reflection is a part of meditation, which one can take out, as it were, and take into mindfulness in daily life. Really valuable. And of course we also know that if you persist even further with meditation and become practiced at it, you begin to find that altered states of consciousness arise. That's rather a pompous phrase, perhaps, but basically the mind can become very spacey. Moments of bliss may arise, surprisingly. Peace may be there, and so on. I needn't go on about this. Those of you who have not had the good fortune of touching those spaces yet, I encourage you to persist with the practice, with the methods, because those kind of states are states which can be brought about by effort, and they are very encouraging states. These are not, I'm not talking here about enlightenment experiences, that's a separate issue, but these states which come about through the practice of samatha, calming the mind, are very, very valuable indeed, and not to be sneezed at by any means. And they can lead to wonderful experiences, for example, feeling at one with the cosmos, and so on, at one, oneness. And that feeling of oneness is the psychological form of the law of codependent arising, which we talked about yesterday. The law of codependent arising is an intellectual expression of the whole thing, is as it were integrated as one. Now, psychologically, as you limit your focus down to one state, it is as it were discovering the psychological truth of what has been expressed otherwise philosophically. I'll leave you to investigate all that, but it requires reflection. So, in the training to bring about a change in your daily life, the practice of meditation, the practice of reflection in daily life, and thirdly, the actual study of the Dharma. It's well worthwhile being really clear what the Buddha actually said. Most of us probably know the fundamental formulae of the Buddha, as the law of codependent arising, the Four Noble Truths, and so on, with three or four others, the basic formulae. But how many of us have actually done some hard work on the Heart Sutra? The Heart Sutra is quite tricky and needs understanding. Words like emptiness, which we tried to talk about a little bit yesterday, are unfortunately really causes of tripping up. Emptiness is not empty. One has to be very, very careful about how one understands these terms, which are drawn from the subtlety of Buddhist philosophy. Nagarjuna, the great philosopher of emptiness, had a mind as brilliant, almost certainly, as someone like Wittgenstein. These ancient philosophers were titanic philosophers, as those who study them in detail can tell you. And one of the wonderful things of the last 20 or 30 years has been superb studies of these philosophers, mostly by Americans, beginning to uncover the depth and the subtlety of their reasoning. But philosophy is not for everybody. But some kind of an understanding of the actual arguments and the ideas of Buddhism are very worthwhile taking up. But this quite often requires teaching because of the trickiness of some of the concepts, which are often very different from the assumptions of Western thought. In fact, that's one of the great values of it, that it is different from Western thought. So, in talking about responsibility, what I'm suggesting is that one needs to take up these issues, going beyond the feeling that what I'm aiming for is some kind of Big Bang experience. When Shifu asked, "Are you spreading the Dharma?" he meant, are you sharing the Dharma in a way that attracts other people to investigate it too? That, I think, is the important point. If you can share your own increase in happiness, not perfect maybe, but your own increase in self-ease with others, then that helps other people. It's not that we want to have 100 people in this hall, that's not the point. But if we can make other people a little bit happier as a result of the kind of slight increase in happiness that we ourselves may be discovering, that is spreading the Dharma. I think that's enough for this morning.